Good Tuesday afternoon. This is Ozarks at Large for September 15th, 2020, on your public radio station, 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Ahead this afternoon, in the 1960s and 70s, there were relatively few African-American students on the University of Arkansas campus and even fewer opportunities for students of color to be represented or included in campus life and decisions. A class this semester examines the students who worked to change the policies of inclusion from the 1960s through today. We'll find out more in our second half hour. The Arkansas Department of Health is reporting 399 new cases of COVID-19 and 10 additional deaths from the virus. 986 Arkansans have now died from the disease since the start of the pandemic. The updated numbers come from 6,200 test results. Four counties report more than 20 new cases, including Crawford County with 22. Governor Hutchinson did not host a briefing yesterday, but did take note of the cases in a tweet, writing that yesterday marked a third consecutive day of decreasing numbers after Friday's more than 1,100 new cases report, which set an all-time high for the state. The University of Arkansas is reporting 334 active cases on campus, all but five of those cases diagnosed in students. The university's updated numbers include 25 new positive cases from on-campus testing for Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and 75 self-reported cases for those same 3 days. Since August 10th, the university says it has conducted 4,576 COVID-19 tests. A few clouds tonight, with lows in the mid to upper 60s throughout the KUAF listening area. Slight chance of rain in tomorrow's forecast, about a 20% chance. Highs tomorrow afternoon in the mid-80s. The University of Arkansas Fort Smith hosting its first blood drive of the fall semester today until 3:30, and then tomorrow from 10:30 until 3:30. Each donor will receive a free COVID-19 antibody test. The blood drive takes place at the Smith-Pendergraph Campus Center. It is free and open to the public. Appointments can be made by sending an email to studentactivities@uafs.edu. This is Ozarks at Large. On yesterday's show, we heard from a tenant and advocates for renters who have been struggling to make rent because of lost wages due to COVID-19. In part two of our report, we learned more about the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's eviction moratorium that went into effect this month. Here is Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek.
It's a really big load off my shoulders, you know.
That's Christopher Youngblood again. In part one of our report, he was facing eviction from Southern View Apartments in Fayetteville.
I'll be homeless and I will lose all my possessions because I don't even have money for a storage unit or anything like that.
But for now, at least, the eviction proceedings against him have been put on hold thanks to the eviction moratorium issued by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention that went into effect on September 4th. Youngblood says he found information about how to fill out a declaration statement to stop his eviction through the Legal Aid of Arkansas website.
You have to send your landlord, a declaration first, before that actually can apply to you. And that's something I didn't know. So that website and their service is just spectacular. They actually give you like a template and everything, you can send to your landlord, and they walk you through the steps of filling out the information that pertains to you, it couldn't have been easier.
Once he sent the declaration to his landlord, the attorney for Southern View Apartments withdrew a request for a court hearing, which had been scheduled for Monday morning.
Well, actually, I showed up for the court hearing and stuff, and then they came out and told me, since you send in your paperwork, there's not a hearing today, so you're good.
Kendall Llewellyn is the managing attorney at the Center for Arkansas Legal Services. Like Legal Aid of Arkansas, the Center for Arkansas Legal Services is a nonprofit law firm that provides free legal services to low-income Arkansans in civil matters. Llewellyn says tenants need to know the CDC moratorium doesn't automatically stop evictions for non-payment of rent.
The process is fairly simple, But tenants have to take a couple of steps to be covered. There seems to be a common misconception that, you know, there are just not going to be any evictions for non-payment of rent. But actually, tenants have to do some things to make that happen first.
To qualify, renters have to meet a number of requirements outlined in the CDC declaration form. Some of those include making an effort to get government assistance for rent or housing, making less than $99,000 in individual income a year, receiving a stimulus check under the CARES Act, being unable to pay rent due to loss of household income, fewer hours at work, or extraordinary out-of-pocket medical expenses, and the possibility of ending up homeless or having to move in with other people should an eviction take place.
So that really does cover most people who would be facing eviction for non-payment of rent.
Llewellyn says the renter then has to submit the signed CDC declaration form to their landlord.
You have to sign it under penalty of perjury, which is important. You should consider it carefully before you do it. But you sign it, you date it, you give it to your landlord, and in theory, that should be it.
The declaration is sworn testimony, which means renters could be prosecuted, go to jail, or pay a fine if they lie about any of the information listed on the form.
The minimum fine for violating this is $100,000. So I think most people assume that that would apply to landlords who violate the order, but the order doesn't actually specify, so it could be a tenant as well.
Llewellyn says tenants also need to continue paying whatever rent they can, and the total amount of unpaid rent will come due when the moratorium runs out on December 31st.
The rent is not forgiven, so at the end of the year, you're still going to owe that money, and if you have a huge balance, there's a good chance that you will still be evicted at that time, and your landlord can still charge late fees.
And she wants to remind renters they can still be evicted for reasons other than non-payment of rent.
So we're expecting to see a lot of those coming up soon.
Still, Llewellyn says the moratorium provides one more avenue for tenants to stay in their homes.
If nothing else, it could buy them the time that they need to either get caught up on the rent or find somewhere else to live so that they don't have to be homeless.
Homelessness was a real possibility for Christopher Youngblood just a few days ago. He was one of nearly 400 people across the state who had non-payment complaints filed against them by their landlords in August, which is 40% higher than the complaints filed in July. Those figures come from a database compiled by retired law professor Lynn Foster, who used to work at the University of Arkansas at Little Rock. Since April, Foster has been keeping a database of eviction proceedings and issuing monthly reports.
I'm doing this basically because no one else is doing it and because evictions have assumed a huge importance because of the pandemic.
Foster uses Court Connect, a public database of legal proceedings in Arkansas, to track the cases as they work their way through the legal system.
I'm tracking each eviction to see what happens in every case. I concentrate on evictions for non-payment of rent because those are typically the ones that are protected. They were protected under the CARES Act, and they're protected under the CDC's new order.
When it was first passed, the CARES Act included a 120-day eviction moratorium for renters who participate in federal housing assistance programs or live in a property with a federally backed mortgage. The moratorium prohibited owners of those properties from both filing new evictions against tenants for not paying rent and charging additional fees because of non-payment. But it expired on July 24th, allowing landlords to issue 30-day notices for tenants to vacate properties. The CARES Act also provided $600 additional dollars on top of regular weekly unemployment. But that has run out as well. So Foster says the CDC moratorium provides some welcome relief.
It's half a loaf. The whole loaf would be getting rental assistance to tenants so that they can pay their rent and landlords will continue to receive the income to which they're entitled. This is half a loaf, but it's half a loaf and it's better than none because we really don't want millions of people nationwide turned out in the middle of a pandemic. That would make this public health disaster even so much worse. I don't even want to think about it.
Foster also acknowledges that while the CDC eviction moratorium could help some renters, it could also harm certain landlords.
Some landlords, particularly the big landlords, can sustain a loss like this over several months. But there are lots of small landlords, they're sometimes referred to as mom and pop landlords, who are really depending on this income and who are really hurt by it not coming in.
Although she adds, there's a difference between the loss experienced by tenants and the loss experienced by their landlords.
A tenant loses his home during a pandemic, whereas a landlord is only losing income. That still doesn't mean, of course, that the landlord isn't harmed, but it's a different kind of a harm.
But Taylor Katrubis, who is the owner and operator of Katrubis Properties in Fayetteville, says a prolonged loss of income for a landlord could lead to a loss of housing for tenants.
You know, if our business goes under, it's not just the one family that can't pay rent that has no home to live in. It's all 200 families that, you know, some of them may be paying. And they don't have a home. And now, you know, all these apartments that were available as affordable housing to the community, they all go away. So we sort of have to balance the needs of our business and our family with the needs of our tenants who pay, with the needs of our tenants who can't pay. And it's, you know, it's kind of this delicate rope that we walk.
Katrubis calls her family's business a relatively small fish in a big pond of property owners in Northwest Arkansas.
We're a fully family-owned and operated company, and we have about 200 apartment units and 10 rental homes. So we have no employees. Our family does everything in-house, meaning we do leases, advertising, painting, settling disputes, and even less savory things like unclogging the toilets. But we love it. We built this business up from one small rental home to what it is today, and we're proud of it, and we're proud of the services that we offer to Fayetteville.
She says so far, Katrubis Properties hasn't had to evict anyone because of pandemic-related issues.
You know, our plan, even before the pandemic, when we've had people that couldn't pay, we always worked out a payment plan with them and give them ample time to pay it back, and we let them have input in that payment plan. So they can say, this is how much extra I can pay every month. And we would just let them pay on it that way. And as long as they can keep up on their commitments and we keep up on ours, and we don't evict unless it gets, you know, really bad.
But she adds, that doesn't mean operating during the health emergency hasn't been stressful.
There's a lot of things that go into running an apartment building that people don't consider. We have our mortgage and we have our insurance, but then we also have high property taxes and repairs that can't wait, like air conditioners or appliances, and that can cost thousands of dollars. We have the water bill for 200 people, so if that goes unpaid, no one has water. There's a lot riding on it, so, you know, from the beginning, we've had a lot of anxiety about it.
And now Katrubis says they're trying to figure out what the new CDC eviction moratorium means for them as rental property owners.
We've read through it. It is very difficult to understand, and even our attorney, you know, we have, you know, obviously someone who helps us with all of our leases and whatever, and he emailed us the day that it was issued, and he said he didn't really understand it. So we were all shocked. There was no warning given for it, and there was no request for input.
Katrubis says she wasn't aware the CDC had the authority to issue that kind of directive, and calls the move government overreach, especially since there's been no relief provided to landlords during the pandemic.
Throughout the pandemic, you know, it's been governors like taking recommendations from the CDC and then implementing their own orders, or legislators that we voted on passing laws. And the CDC is just a government agency, so it kind of felt like that came out of left field.
So far, none of her tenants have come in with the CDC declaration form. So Katrubis says they'll deal with that situation if it comes up. As for Christopher Youngblood, he's just grateful to still have a roof over his head.
Now that I have secured housing and stuff, at least for, you know, a couple of months, it allows me to focus on getting back on my feet.
Youngblood is looking for a second job and has every intention of repaying the rent he owes. But he's still worried about one thing.
Well, my main thing really is the late fees and stuff that have been adding up, because that's double my rent almost now. So that's going to be the biggest hurdle to overcome now is just all these late fees that they charge.
The CDC declaration form Youngblood filled out can be found on both the Legal Aid of Arkansas and the Center for Arkansas Legal Services websites, as well as the website for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Zuzana Sitek.
Later today, the Fayetteville City Council will consider a measure that would prohibit landlords from charging late fees for late rent payments until the governor declares an end to the COVID-19 pandemic emergency.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation.
In early August, officials announced the 2020 census would end on September 30th, about a month earlier than expected. At that time, about 57% of Arkansans had completed the survey. According to the official U.S. Census website, Arkansas now has a self-response rate of about 60%. Last week, Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda spoke with Medea Reith, founding executive director of Arkansas United, to find out how her organization is reaching out to the state's immigrant population.
First and foremost, I do want to say that we're party to several lawsuits that are trying to still request an extended time period to complete this year's census, as well as the redistricting process. Again, we're gravely concerned about implications, not just for immigrants, the entire state of Arkansas and our country, by not getting this right and acknowledging the pandemic that we're in. But because we don't know if those lawsuits will be successful, both Arkansas United and Arkansas Counts has really doubled down to really make the most out of this last month for the census. We at Arkansas United, specifically with immigrants, are currently flooding the radio waves across Arkansas. One of the challenges that we confronted throughout this census process, which has actually been really revealing, is Spanish media is not coordinated in the state of Arkansas, and that state agencies, nonprofits, organizations don't have those outlets. And actually, many of the same language barriers that we confront in state agencies and other civic and policy work also applies when it comes to our Spanish media. And the individuals running our Spanish media are monolingual, only speak Spanish themselves, work within the community, have more informal communication with the community than formal structures. And so we really felt that that was an untapped resource that wasn't coordinated, specifically as related to radio and newspaper. And so have been trying to bring that to the table now, both for census and for COVID. And in addition to that, we are driving calls into Latinx families and communities. A lot going on. We have a voter registration, absentee ballot deadlines as well. And so we're trying to integrate all of these civic messages as we're talking to our community by phone, putting bilingual individuals in spaces to be able to talk through our community about these opportunities. And we're excited here to be supporting Census Saturdays across the state, which we're doing in coordination with several cities. And also there'll be a drive-through event here in a couple weeks where we'll be able to simultaneously help individuals both with absentee ballots, voter registration, but also it's a final push on this on the census.
So tell me more about these census Saturdays. If people are doing, what is it? And you mentioned kind of a drive-through. If somebody does a drive-through, can you literally take them through the census and just get it off checked and done?
Correct. Yeah. As much as COVID really was an impediment, and we did discourage a lot of face-to-face interaction, our own staff made the appeal to us here at Arkansas United to get back to face-to-face as best as they could. And we felt that we had some good models to build off of, especially for those that had already done some of these food drops, right, with drive-by food distributions and really trying to, throughout this COVID crisis, find creative ways to try and stay safe but still engage with the community. And so we do have our navigators absolutely geared up, but we have been able to now on a weekly basis, and now cities are doing this as well as other nonprofits, but to try and create spaces where individuals can on tablets fill out the census or with clipboards complete any paperwork while a other volunteers are filling up their trunks with food, backpacks, and other resources, trying to address the urgent needs, acknowledging that we all have to be real, that what's going to bring people out isn't the census, it's not voting, but it's about those basic survival needs that are important now. But in doing so, we know that those long lines have just been tremendous opportunities where we have volunteers going car to car and being able to take some much appreciated time to be able to also help them fulfill the civic opportunities and responsibilities that they have.
When you have the opportunity to have these one-on-one conversations, either over the phone or in person, mm-hmm. what are you finding in the Spanish-speaking community in terms of, you know, why they haven't already done the census? Is it just a lack of educational information, or is there a mistrust because the information has primarily been delivered in English? What are you finding?
No, unfortunately, we haven't made much progress over the last 6 months of this pandemic in terms of really being able to lift up civic engagement and these civic tasks as a priority for the community. Just we continue to hear stories of folks. I can't even think about that. We don't have bandwidth for that when we're trying to deal with how do I keep my lights from getting turned off? How do I have gas for the weekends? How do I even feed my family? And so that was where we really had to acknowledge and be humble in these conversations and say that we had to meet the community where they're at. And if what they need is food, if what they need is assistance, then let's give them assistance. And then through that, try and give hope and trust that then lets us engage in these other conversations. But overall, as a whole, our community is very worried about the system. They're very worried about the elections and what's going to be the impact. And it really is, it's about those individual touches and it's about the help that they're getting with and from their neighbors that's inspiring them to say, okay, if this is someone that's going to care enough to feed me and take care of my family, then I'll listen to them about doing something for my community by doing the census.
Throughout the whole census campaign, something you hear a lot about is working really hard to reach the hard to count communities in Arkansas. You know, who are those hard to count communities? Who are some of those communities that still just aren't, there isn't a high response rate?
For us, when 20 lowest turnout counties here in Arkansas, I can say that the persistent hard to count has just as much as to do with socioeconomics and the rural circumstances of the community as it does with demographics. We do have and continue to feel that our African American and Latinx communities are extremely vulnerable, but there has been a lot of coordination with Arkansas counts to really think about communication tools that will work in rural communities. So maybe engaging some of these more localized radio stations, purchasing of billboards, and really acknowledging that our rural and just socioeconomic pinched communities are struggling also to make the case for the census and very much are hard to count for us in Arkansas.
Do you feel like all of the pushes, the efforts that's been made, especially in the last month or so, is working? Are you being able to move that needle just a little bit more of more people being counted?
We do feel that we can point to progress and definitely in subsequent rounds with our phone banking as Arkansas United. And we've also been using a text message system. We are getting higher and higher percentages of folks indicating that, yes, they have responded to the census. That's encouraging. But we are getting some mixed messages in regards to the official count. And when we're looking at Arkansas's participation rates, Arkansas is still ranked pretty low in the country, but the Census Bureau has separately contacted our state complete count committee vis-a-vis the governor's office and did indicate that Arkansas was in the top tier of turnouts. So it may not be that everything is getting to the website, and because Arkansas is actually one of the top in the country in opting for the paper option, that may be some of the discrepancies in where we're seeing the participation rates, but some hopeful signs, at least it seems from our Census Bureau, that our efforts are working, our shared efforts are working.
Well, thank you so much for your time and best of luck with your final push with the census.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for helping us continue to get the word out there.
That was Medea Reith, founding executive director of Arkansas United, speaking with Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda. For more information on upcoming census outreach events, visit facebook.com/arimmigrants or arcounts.org.
For more than 30 years, you have turned to KUAF and Ozarks at Large for important, insightful, and intelligent news about our community. This fall, KUAF is turning to you. We're raising money during the month of September to keep Ozarks at Large and all the important programs you rely on every day on the air. Listeners who give to the station provide more than 75% of our funding. You can be a part of our fall fundraising month and make a difference to your public radio station. Make a gift today at supportkuaf.com. Thank you.
Good Tuesday. This is Ozarks at Large. In 1969, the University of Arkansas had about 9,000 students enrolled in classes. About 150 of those students were Black. Students of color had little representation in university activities and little input toward student policy. But there were students who worked for change in the 1960s and 70s, and an honors class taking place this semester at the U of A will introduce students of 2020 to some of those students from decades past. The class is led by Charles Robinson, interim provost at the university and a professor of history at the University of Arkansas. He's also the author of the book Remembrances in Black, Personal Perspectives of the African-American Experience at the University of Arkansas. He says this class developed in part through conversations with Dr. Lonnie Williams, a graduate of the U of A and one-time director of the school's Multicultural Center. And Robinson says during his research, he discovered a newspaper once published at the university called Bad Times. It was an offshoot of the student group Black Americans for Democracy, or BAD.
And I discovered this newspaper that a student group of African Americans had put together called Bad Times. And it was in our university archive, and learn more about that student organization and how it formed. It formed as a resistance to what it saw as the failure of the traveler to deliver fair news about the MLK assassination. They failed to publish an article written by an African-American student. And so that launched a desire to protest the traveler, but then also establish this medium then whereby they could get their voices out. And it became a really important tool for the entire campus, but particularly for African-American students to push the issues that they thought were important, and to try to really diversify the campus in some meaningful ways.
In the late 60s, what was representation for African-Americans like in university organizations, be it the Traveler or student government? It wasn't much, was it?
No, I think Gerald Jordan actually worked for the Traveler.
That's true.
In the late 60s, but he's the only one that I'm aware of as African-American student. But you just didn't have nearly the type of infrastructure for African-American students, for inclusion, that what I feel that we have today. And there were only African-Americans at that time. There were only about 150 African-Americans out of a population of students over 9,000. So 1.7% of the population. Faculty numbers were really, really small as well. I think there were two African-American faculty members by 69. So it was just not nearly a place that embraced or welcomed these students in a way that made them feel like they really had a foundation here and a place for them here. And there were so many programs that we have today that simply did not exist that featured and focused on African-American culture in some way, shape, or form.
Can you tell through historical research if there was any desire, be it Board of Trustees or university administration in the 1960s, to increase representation or African-American population among faculty or students?
Well, you know, desire is, there's a rhetoric of desire, and then there's a reality that's usually accompanied with resources of some sort. And there were some federal investigations of U of A campus reality that really encouraged us, forced our hands as a campus. Now, I'm sure those studies were part of the reasons why we moved, but the students themselves and their willingness to take on the administration, go into President Mullen's office and drop off a list of demands, you know, to protest. I mean, that was very, very important to this whole process of change on the campus. The students themselves created organizations that would become, institutional organizations over time, but the students started those organizations. Like the first African-American choir, it wasn't called Inspire, but it was a choir that the students who were part of BAD started. I mean, of course, it led to Inspire. And that's what I mean by the students themselves pushed the university towards becoming more of a desegregated campus. They didn't simply allow administrators to move at their own pace.
You mentioned already Gerald Jordan, a couple of other students that were there then who will be leading some of the forums for the students this time, right?
Oh, yeah, that's what I'm most excited about, is that these real life historical figures, people who were actors in this time, will get a chance to talk about their experiences, what it was like to live through this time and to provide some context to the students about their experiences and looking back on that and what it means. And we bring the class all the way up to the current time and the kneeling Razorbacks, for example, with the Lady Razorback. We have a representative from that team who's going to come in. I remember her, she was a freshman at the time, and she will talk about what that experience was like. And then in this most recent iteration of kind of African-American student protest, the hashtag Black at UARC, we have a person who has been involved in that. So what I'm hoping the students to see is the continuity of protest, but also how change has also affected the campus and also the methods of protest for the students of color here at the University of Arkansas.
When you look at the students then who will be speaking to students now, it's not surprising that they have turned into leaders throughout their adult life, be it at the Philadelphia Inquirer and later a journalism sure. professor like Gerald Jordan, legislature, mayors, leading attorneys, cutting their professional leadership teeth while at the U of A.
Right. The book Lonnie Williams and I did in the interviews, people often talked about how difficult a time they had here at the University of Arkansas, socially, emotionally. But generally speaking, they valued their time here because it helped to shape them for the careers that they would go on to have. And they really talked about building the foundation of their kind of education, the educational foundation. They praised the opportunity and the faculty in terms of how they were very serious professionals and helped them to learn in a way that served as a foundational tool for their future success.
You mentioned Lonnie Williams, who mentioned some of the emotional and prejudice that he felt here and lack of inclusion. Then he becomes a mentor and a guide to students throughout several generations at the University of Arkansas. I'm wondering if you ever had the conversation with him, why come to the institution that at times could be so difficult to be a member of as a student?
And we've talked, Lonnie was here when I came as an assistant professor back in 99, and he was very helpful to me just to get grounded and started here, you know, introducing me to different people. I think he felt that here, that the university, despite its challenges, it was a place where there was real opportunity for people of color to come and develop, and students to come and learn and develop. So it's back to what we just referenced. The school had challenges relative to inclusion, but there were some foundational aspects of this institution that he found rewarding, meaningful, purposeful. And the hope was that we could change what needed to be changed and maintain, you know, the positive aspects of those things that helped shape people and made them the professionals that they would go on to become.
What's it like for a historian to cover a subject that for some of us seems like more or less recent or recent-ish history, but to the students, I'm guessing, is going to sound more like antiquity or ancient history? This was happening several, you know, years before they were even born.
Yeah. Well, I mean, to me, I tell my students when I teach them that my courses are rated R. And what that means is that I keep them real. In other words, we deal with the facts. I mean, I don't make up facts. Facts are what they are. And some of these facts you will embrace gleefully. Others you will question and challenge. But they are, you know, facts of record. And then I try to, the second R is to make history relevant. I mean, and so to work on history that's this relevant to students is powerful to me. It's a great learning opportunity. And it's also opportunity for me to continue to learn, because the question of continuity versus change, you know, with the recent murder of George Floyd, American society is looking at its kind of civil rights history and asking, have we really changed all that much? Or are we, you know, more of the society that we thought that we had moved away from? And I think, you know, in many ways, University of Arkansas and this whole issue of bad and student protests is a microcosm of that larger conversation. And the students who have expressed over the summer some of their concerns talked about some similar themes that you found from students of color back in the 60s. And the question for, I think, for this course is, what truly is similar and what's different? And how do we make all this make sense and give us some better sense of where we are as a campus and also as a nation on this, you know, civil rights pendulum?
Charles Robinson is interim provost at the University of Arkansas and a professor of history. He's leading a class this fall about the work of Black students, faculty, and administrators who work to create more inclusion at the University of Arkansas over the past several decades. He's also the author of the book, Remembrances in Black, Personal Perspectives of the African American Experience at the University of Arkansas. He spoke with us via Zoom.
Support for KUAF comes from the Walmart Museum on the square in downtown Bentonville. The museum and Walton's Five and Dime are temporarily closed. However, the Spark Cafe is open for walk-up service noon to 9 p.m. daily. More information is available at walmartmuseum.com. The Scott Family Amazium is hosting virtual summer camps for children ages 6 to 12 years old. Camp materials and supplies for hands-on interactive experiences will be sent to homes 1 week prior to start. These camps are designed with activities in mind, and screen time will be limited. Amazium.org/programs for more information.
This is Ozarks at Large. Local artist M.M. Kent has self-published A Coward's Guide to Oil Painting, the novel. The coming-of-age magical mystery love story is set in the hippie subculture of 1969, with a pair of characters traversing the American South and the wilds of Mexico on two separate quests. And yes, as Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports, the author opens each chapter with nuanced guidance on Painting with Oils.
Much of the time, noted impressionist painter M.M. Kent inhabits Wings and Roots, his South Fayetteville studio, which features a lush landscape and a curious large round window. He shares a home next door with wife Annie. Together, they've raised 7 children who've provided 11 grandchildren and 1 grandchild on the way. An award-winning professional artist this year, M.M. Kent has also managed to raise his own novel, partly based on his imagination and partly on his life.
Yeah, what prompted a 70-year-old grandpa to write a novel? From time to time, I've been asked to teach, so I developed some exercises for my students and jokingly called them A Coward's Guide to Oil Painting. So that was the inception of the title, and I've just hung on to it. But I started journaling many years ago, probably 12 years ago, I guess. And the journal entries developed into a story.
The cover of the book released in late July is an oil painting by Kent of a blonde woman, a satchel thrown over her shoulder, stepping through an antique windowed doorway into a turquoise atmosphere beyond.
This is a quote from CJ, one of the narrators. Before I ever thought about telling a story, I painted, first in watercolor, then oil. Before that, I drew with fingers, crayons, and pencils. Whatever was at hand. It's all the same, really, making a picture, leaving a track. So here I'm learning to paint with words instead of brushes, looking to capture an elusive trail of light. I expect I'll write the same as I paint, by plunging in and thrashing around until the words start to make sense.
Kent says A Coward's Guide to Oil Painting is essentially a love story.
But it's not a romance, at least not in the sense that most of us think of a romance. It's a guide to oil painting. In fact, each chapter begins with a little piece about painting or seeing or something artistic. So a person could glean enough to kind of get started with oil painting by reading the book. So that's sort of an added bonus. But yes, it's a love story, and it's a slow burning suspense story also, and an adventure. So it's got it crosses a lot of genres, and I'm still waiting for someone to tell me what it really is.
The book is centered on CJ, an artist newly graduated from college. He's seeking adventure. He meets a woman named Mariah. She's seeking an experience back on the land, also a college graduate. It's circa 1969.
She's looking for a safe place, but at the same time, she wants to save the world. So she has a sort of a built-in conflict. And her travels with friends in an old school bus take her to Austin, where she has an improbable encounter with CJ, and they go up separate ways, but their paths converge throughout the rest of the story. Anyway, CJ, after his experience with Mariah, gets in trouble and ends up in Mexico, where he learns oil painting while searching for his brother, who's gone missing.
Kent's color-drenched novel, he says, is attracting good reader reviews so far.
A quirky love story, a deep story with well-developed characters and a good sense of humor.
Because of the pandemic, he's delayed book touring for A Coward's Guide to Oil Painting, the novel, for now. The trade paperback and digital edition are available wherever books are sold, he says.
And my website is mmkent.net. That's my author's website,
where you can also view M.M. Kent's oil paintings and drawings. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
Buffalo National River Park Service staff discovered what they describe as significant damage inside Fitton Cave, one of the largest cave systems in Arkansas. The cave sits on park property in Newton County. Casey Brandstetter is the branch chief of interpretation and the public information officer for the Buffalo National River Park.
All caves in Buffalo National River have been closed to the public since 2009 due to white nose syndrome, It's a deadly fungus that can decimate bat populations. And we've been trying to protect our bat populations just by keeping the public out of these delicate cave environments. However, research can still be done in these areas. We have cave researchers who work for the park, and in August of this year, we had some cave researchers who worked for the park who were entering Fitton Cave and discovered the damage there.
Brandstetter says vandals broke into the gated cave, apparently to steal geological formations,
such as stalagmites and drapery. Another type of cave formation. Those were not only broken off and damaged, they were also removed from the spaces.
The National Park Service is investigating the crime and is asking the public for help.
We are encouraging anyone who has any information on the crime that has occurred in Fitton Cave to provide feedback to the Investigative Services Branch of the National Park Service. We're taking anonymous tips. That can be done online or on phone. And if you have any information, please feel free to share. This is a piece of heritage that belongs to every single citizen of the nation, being a part of our federal public lands. And the removal of these items, the damage of these geologic resources, are things that really hard to place a monetary value on. And just to understand the depth of damage that's been done, basically. It can take thousands of years for cave formations to form.
And anybody with information about the damage in Fitton Cave can call the National Park Service Investigative Services Branch tip line. It's free, 888-653-0009. You can also submit a tip online at nps.gov/ISB. This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, and Boonville. 91.3 KUAF is a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. Contributors to this edition of Ozarks at Large included Zuzana Sitek, Antoinette Grajeda, and Jacqueline Froelich. Jacqueline also gave us news about the cave damage in the Buffalo National River State Park. Timothy Dennis produced our show from his home studio in downtown Fayetteville. You can learn more about us by going to ozarksatlarge.com. Also there, you can find past editions of our program as well as individual stories and interviews that we allow you to share with people through email or social media. We have links to each of the stories that let you do this. Thanks so much for spending part of your Tuesday with us. We have another brand new show for you at noon tomorrow from the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio at the Carver Center for Public Radio in Fayetteville. I'm Kyle Kellums. Please take care of yourself. Get rest when you can.